There is, of course, only one way to prove that somebody accusing you of lying about suicidal thoughts is wrong, but Morgan seemed not to care. Neither had this self-appointed interrogator of Meghan Markle's integrity previously demonstrated much concern about his old friend Donald Trump's obvious contempt for the truth, common decency, or any woman's right not to be grabbed by the pussy. His departure from Good Morning Britain was a rare example of a right-wing media darling facing genuine professional consequences for an egregious breach of the standards by which the rest of society is expected to abide. At least at work, Clarkson retained his various positions in the Murdoch empire after an unconvincing apology, but Morgan, whose obsession with the Duchess of Sussex often seems psychotic, refused to do even that. No matter, he was soon back on the Murdoch payroll at The Sun and back on screen at Murdoch's Talk TV, albeit with audience figures that often failed to trouble the scorers. As Christine Flack so powerfully illustrated, people like Clarkson, Morgan, and, as we shall see, a surprisingly small coterie of other columnists across Murdoch titles, The Telegraph, Mail, and Andrew Neil's Spectator, have commoditized cruelty in a way that now appears completely normal to the British public. It is a form of psychological grooming that demeans us all, and, again, it is now almost impossible to achieve any success in the British media without being at least somewhat complicit in the practice. The third and final element of Murdoch's capture of a country's soul is the willingness not just to mould facts to the agendas shared with governments, but to abandon facts altogether in pursuit of them. There are countless examples, but this one is particularly pertinent to our purpose here. Bizarrely, given that there are no majority Muslim countries in the European Union, carefully cultivated Islamophobia played a crucial role in the Brexit referendum. Many of the protagonists in this book, including Boris Johnson, Andrew Neil's Spectator, and Dominic Cummings, contributed to this ugly phenomenon, but none did so as brazenly as Rupert Murdoch's son. On the 13th of November 2015, 130 people died in Islamist terrorist attacks in Paris. 10 days later, The Sun published the front-page headline, "One in Five Brit Muslims Sympathy for Jihadis." Accompanied by an image of British ISIS member Mohammed Emwazi, known as Jihadi John, the story purported to report the findings of a survey of British Muslims commissioned by The Sun immediately after the Paris attacks. The intention was clear. Inside the paper, one columnist wrote under the headline, "This shocking poll means we must shut door on young Muslim migrants." The Sun's respectable stablemate, The Times, followed up the story the following day. But 12 days after that, a paragraph appeared in their corrections and clarifications on page 36, admitting that their headline, "One in Five British Muslims Has Sympathy for ISIS," was misleading. This was hardly surprising. The day after The Sun's front page appeared, the company responsible for the poll issued the following statement. "Servation do not support or endorse the way in which this poll's findings have been interpreted. Neither the headline nor the body text of articles published were discussed with or approved by Servation prior to publication. Furthermore, Servation categorically objects to the use of any of our findings by any group, as has happened elsewhere on social networks, to incite racial or religious tensions." Inciting racial or religious tensions has, of course, been the stock in trade of right-wing newspapers for years. It was 4 months later, in March of the following year, before The Sun admitted its story had been significantly misleading. A four-month delay, even though the 3,000 complaints received by the press watchdog, the Independent Press Standards Organisation, or IPSO, dwarfed the 400 received after another Sun columnist, Katie Hopkins, described migrants as cockroaches in an article the previous April. An IPSO spokesman said, "The newspaper had provided various interpretations of the poll result, which conflated important distinctions between those travelling to Syria and those already fighting in Syria, between sympathy for these individuals and support for their actions, and between individuals attracted by the ideology of ISIS and the ideology of ISIS itself. The complaints committee deemed that the newspaper had failed to take appropriate care in its presentation of the poll results, and as a result, the coverage was significantly misleading in breach of Clause 1, accuracy." The Sun was required by IPSO to publish its adjudication on page 2 of the paper. Nobody knows who first coined the phrase, "A lie is halfway round the world before the truth has got its boots on." Inevitably, Winston Churchill, Mark Twain and Oscar Wilde have all been erroneously credited with it. But there can be little doubt about how true it remains, or about how completely that truth is understood by Rupert Murdoch's editors and columnists. And it is to two very different Murdoch editors we turn now, for first, an example of just how low they are prepared to go, and second, an explanation of the single, long-denied moment in British history that allowed it all to happen. The Hillsborough disaster may feel a long time ago, but its legacy continues to reverberate, not only for the friends and families of those directly affected, but for what it demonstrates about the insidious power of the media and its close links to government power. On the 15th of April 1989, Liverpool and Nottingham Forest football clubs met to contest an FA Cup semi-final on the neutral ground of Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield, South Yorkshire. There followed a human tragedy of almost unimaginable proportions, ultimately leaving 97 people dead and 766 injured. It is important to bear in mind throughout what follows that Leveson 2, abandoned by the Conservatives in 2017, was going to investigate clandestine relationships and inappropriate connections between the police and journalists. And it is important to remember that we are concerned here not with rehearsing all the facts of the tragedy itself, but with chronicling the slow decline of British journalism that began when Murdoch bought the News of the World in 1968 and The Sun in 1969. It has certainly never fallen faster or further than it did 4 days after the disaster, when the editor of The Sun, Kelvin McKenzie, embarked upon a course of personal depravity and professional delinquency that would continue to cause pain and anguish to bereaved Hillsborough families for decades to come. After multiple inquiries and investigations, and one of the most tireless pursuits of justice in British history, we now know that the disaster occurred because the police superintendent in charge of the game, David Duckenfield, ordered an exit gate to be opened in the hope of easing overcrowding at the entry turnstiles. The ensuing rush into the Leppings Lane stand caused the overcrowding and subsequent crushing that would take so many lives. It was almost 26 years before Duckenfield finally admitted that his claim on the day that a gate had been forced and there had been an inrush of Liverpool supporters that had caused casualties had been a lie. It is impossible to imagine this lie remaining at the heart of the official version of events for decades without the strenuous support of Murdoch's newspaper and establishment figures, including Margaret Thatcher's press secretary, Bernard Ingham. Ingham, who visited the stadium with Thatcher the day after the tragedy, would become one of the most vociferous defenders of the entirely bogus and deeply offensive account of events propagated by police and, as we shall see, Kelvin McKenzie. In 1996, Ingham even wrote to a Liverpool fan, Graham Skinner, who had tried to draw his attention to Hillsborough, a television drama written by Jimmy McGovern that saw the story told for the first time from the perspective of Hillsborough families. The letter is reproduced in full here because it provides a truly grim illustration of just how much harm can be done to a democracy when political, police, and media interests work in conjunction to deny the public access to the truth. In this case, the parties were South Yorkshire Police, prominent Tories like Ingham and the local MP Irvin Patnick, later knighted, and sympathetic journalists. It creates an environment in which all three institutions believe, with considerable justification, that they can do whatever they please without censure from the only powerful potential critics of their conduct, each other. Precisely the problem that Leveson 2 was supposed to interrogate. Thank you for your letter of December 11. I believe that there would have been no Hillsborough disaster if tanked-up yobs had not turned up in very large numbers to try to force their way into the ground. I visited Hillsborough the day after the disaster, and I know what I learned then. I have never denied that the police may have made mistakes, but I firmly believe that the Lord Chief Justice whitewashed the real culprits, and I said so from the moment I read his report. I have not seen the McGovern film, but I am long enough in the tooth to know that TV films should never be accepted as evidence. But let us suppose there is something in the film. For example, the evidence that the pens were already full when the gates were opened. What, then, were all those people doing trying to get into the ground? I have never, of course, said where they came from because I do not know. I have no intention of apologising for my views, which are sincerely held on the basis of what I heard firsthand at Hillsborough. I have, however, one suggestion to make. For its own good, Liverpool, with the Heysel disaster in the background, should shut up about Hillsborough. Nothing can bring back those who died. Innocent people who, by virtue of being in the ground early, had their lives crushed out of them by a mob surging in late. To go on about it serves only to confirm in many people's minds that Liverpool has a very bad conscience about soccer disasters. I think it is a disgrace to the public service that South Yorkshire policemen have won the right to compensation. But it will do Liverpool no good whatsoever in the eyes of the nation if, egged on by ambulance-chasing lawyers, those who saw their relatives killed at Hillsborough now sue for compensation for the trauma. Is the pain of losing a relative to be soothed away by a fat check? Take my advice, Mr. Skinner. Least said, soonest mended for Liverpool. On September the 12th, 2012, the Hillsborough Independent Panel stated definitively that Liverpool fans had been in no way responsible for the disaster, laying the blame instead at the feet of South Yorkshire Police. The panel also found that 164 witness statements had been tampered with, mostly to remove or alter negative comments about South Yorkshire Police. On the 26th of April 2016, 27 years after the disaster, an inquest jury ruled that the 96 victims had been unlawfully killed. Andrew Devine became the 97th victim in 2021 when he died from irreversible brain damage suffered on the day, and that the fans had not contributed to the tragic events. Incredibly, Ingham, who was knighted by Margaret Thatcher and died in 2023 without expressing a single word of apology or contrition for his role in disseminating the Hillsborough lies, was not the worst offender in this grim saga. On the 19th of April 1989, under the front page headline, The Truth, Kelvin McKenzie published a list of falsehoods so eye-wateringly offensive that even 3.5 decades later, it is hard to believe they ever saw the light of day. We know from the later testimony of the journalist who wrote the original story, Harry Arnold, that McKenzie was personally responsible for the composition of the front page, which stated unequivocally that some fans picked pockets of victims, some fans urinated on the brave cops, and some fans beat up PC giving kiss of life. And we know that McKenzie arrogantly resisted all pleas to moderate his outrageous copy because Arnold gave an interview to the BBC programme, Hillsborough, Searching for the Truth, in 2012, in which he stated that his original story had been fair and balanced and that it made clear that the claims McKenzie described as the truth had been allegations. He explained, on The Sun, Kelvin McKenzie was the rather controversial editor at the time. He liked to write his own headlines. He wrote the headline, The Truth. And the reason I know that is I was about to leave the newsroom when I saw him drawing up the front page. When I saw the headline, The Truth, I was aghast because that wasn't what I'd written. I'd never used the words, The Truth. This is the truth about the Hillsborough disaster. I'd merely written, I hoped and I still believe, in a balanced and fair way. So I said to Kelvin McKenzie, you can't say that. And he said, why not? And I said, because we don't know that it's the truth. This is a version of the truth. And he brushed it aside and said, oh, don't worry. I'm going to make it clear that this is what some people are saying. And I walked away thinking, well, I'm not happy with the situation. But the fact is, reporters don't argue with an editor. And in particular, you don't argue with an editor like Kelvin McKenzie. A year after the disaster, Peter Chippendale and Chris Horry published their seminal account of the Sun's first 20 years under Murdoch's ownership, Stick It Up Your Punter. In it, they wrote of that infamous front page. As McKenzie's layout was seen by more and more people, a collective shudder ran through the office. But McKenzie's dominance was so total that there was nobody left in the organisation who could rein him in except Murdoch. Everyone in the office seemed paralysed, looking like rabbits in the headlights, as one hack described them. The error staring them in the face was too glaring. It obviously wasn't a silly mistake, nor was it a simple oversight. Nobody really had any comment on it. They just took one look and went away shaking their heads in wonder at the enormity of it. It was a classic smear. The grossness, evident even to McKenzie's traditionally unshockable colleagues, was good for business. And for years, Murdoch's man revelled in the notoriety. There was a pathetic attempt at apology in 2012 when the Hillsborough Independent Panel's report was published. But 4 years later, his continuing contempt for the bereaved families crept into a column he wrote for The Sun, mulling the prospect of a peerage, laughable then but perfectly plausible now that Boris Johnson has so completely debased the honours system. He wrote, Lord Kelv of Anfield has a ring to it. Anfield is, of course, the home of Liverpool Football Club. Much more remarkable than the characteristic obnoxiousness this displays is the platform on which it was published. For such is Murdoch's patronage of his most favoured puppets, Mackenzie was back on the paper with a column in 2016 and remained there after his utter disregard for the truth in his Hillsborough coverage had become public knowledge. Indeed, it was Mackenzie who wrote that Islamophobic column based on the willfully spurious reading of the Servation poll. On the 14th of April 2017, he wrote a column comparing Ross Barkley, the mixed-race Everton footballer, to a gorilla, and once again disparaging the people of Liverpool. He was immediately suspended and shortly afterwards left the paper for the final time. It seems almost ironic that racism had become a sackable offence in Murdoch's empire by 2017. In Stick It Up Your Punter, Chippendale and Horry quote Mackenzie's own description of exactly how he saw his role and his readers in the early 1980s. "You just don't understand the readers, do you, eh? He's the bloke you see in the pub, a right old fascist, wants to send the wogs back, buy his poxy council house. He's afraid of the unions, afraid of the Russians, hates the queers and the weirdos and drug dealers." Despite, or perhaps because of, wearing his bigotry so blatantly on his sleeve, Mackenzie was hired by Paul Dacre to write a column for the Daily Mail in 2011. He lasted a year. In 2013, he was signed up by the online edition of the Daily Telegraph. He lasted for one column. When it comes to stoking hatred of ethnic minorities and gay people, there is, as this career trajectory shows, little distinction between the Sun of the 1980s and ostensibly more respectable organs in the 21st century. Just as Charles Moore's racist comments about young black men in 1992 proved no obstacle to him becoming editor of the Sunday Telegraph and later Daily Telegraph, so Mackenzie's long history of performative obnoxiousness barely impinged on his employability. In his later years, he was mostly to be found running unsuccessfully for his local council on a promise to reduce car parking charges and spewing bile on Twitter and cable television to a negligible number of followers and viewers. But his life's work remains a testament to what can happen in a once proud industry when someone devoid of morality, integrity, and honesty is given free rein by an indulgent billionaire newspaper owner. The late Sir Harold Harry Evans was, to say the least, a rather different beast. He had been editor of the Sunday Times for 14 years when Murdoch bought the title in 1981. Bruised, no doubt, by his departure from the post a year later, Evans, a critic of Margaret Thatcher's ailing premiership, later maintained that Murdoch immediately moved him to the editorship of the Daily Times in order to weaken his position and make it easier to show him the door soon after. When archived papers were released by the Margaret Thatcher Trust in 2012, Evans, who had led a failed staff takeover of the Sunday Times, saw a 30-year-old suspicion spectacularly vindicated. Despite denials both from Downing Street at the time and later in the official history of the Times, the Murdoch years, published in 2005, Murdoch had met with Margaret Thatcher in 1981 to discuss his desire to add the Times and the Sunday Times to the Sun and the News of the World in a deal that would give him control over just shy of 40% of the UK's print media. A note by Bernard Ingham refers to a lunch with Mr. Murdoch at Chequers on the 4th of January 1981, to be treated commercial, in confidence. It contains details of Murdoch's plans to buy the Times titles from the Thompson family and shows that the meeting was held at Murdoch's request. Despite sending a thank you note 2 weeks later, Murdoch claimed to have no recollection of the meeting in his evidence to Leveson in 2012, something to which Lord Justice Leveson referred pointedly in his final report. That there was a confidential meeting between the then Prime Minister and Mr. Murdoch, the fact of which did not emerge into the public domain for more than 30 years, is troubling in its lack of transparency. It serves as a reminder of the importance of contemporary practice to make public the fact of such meetings. The perceptions at the time and since of collusive arrangements between the Prime Minister and the preferred bidder are corrosive of public confidence. It is perhaps a little surprising that he does not remember a visit to a place as memorable as Chequers in the context of a bid as important as that which he made for Times newspapers. However, perhaps that is all I need to say. At issue at the time was the question of whether Murdoch's mooted purchase would be referred to the Monopolies and Mergers Commission, MMC. It was, to say the least, a delicate matter. The Fair Trading Act, 1973, required all newspaper takeovers to be submitted to the MMC unless the Secretary of State for Trade certified a paper was unprofitable and under threat of closure. Evans insisted to the last that the Sunday Times was in a much healthier financial position than its Daily Stablemate and so should be subject to MMC referral. Murdoch was seemingly less keen on the prospect. Either way, immediately after returning to Downing Street from Chequers, Thatcher summoned her trade secretary, the famously robust John Knott, and told him he was being moved to defence. The rather less robust John Biffin was immediately installed at trade and elected not to refer the deal to the MMC. Evans, who died in 2020, always insisted that the Sunday Times books had been cooked and that Biffin consequently misled the House of Commons. Biffin, who died in 2007, later wrote in his autobiography that the Times deal relied on both the Times and Sunday Times being loss-making. There was no doubt about the former, but the Sunday Times was a close-run thing. On the 27th of January 1981, barely 3 weeks after the Chequers meeting that Murdoch presumably still can't recall, his takeover of the Times and the Sunday Times was approved by the House of Commons. Margaret Thatcher, who would enjoy the full-throated support of Murdoch's titles for the duration of her premiership, imposed a three-line whip on her MPs. In 2015, Harry Evans updated the preface to his 1983 memoir, Good Times, Bad Times, to accommodate subsequent events. Perhaps with Andy Coulson and Kelvin McKenzie in mind, he wrote, "All the wretches in the subsequent hacking sagas, the predators in the red tops, the scavengers and sleaze merchants, the blackmailers and bribers, the liars, the bullies, the cowed politicians and the bent coppers were but the detritus of a collapse of integrity in British journalism and political life. At the root of the cruelties and extortions exposed in the recent criminal trials at the Old Bailey was Margaret Thatcher's reckless engorgement of the media power of her guest that January Sunday. The simple genesis of the hacking outrages is that Murdoch's News International came to think it was above the law because it was." Any contemplation of Rupert Murdoch's decades-long dominance of British and American media, his capture of government and his deliberate demolition of journalistic values leaves one burning question. Why did he never emulate the corrosive but considerable success of Fox News in the United Kingdom? The answer is sadly simple. On this side of the Atlantic, the lucrative business of taking the commoditization of hate, the othering of minorities, the demonization of racial or religious difference, and the denigration of dissent to a whole new level had already been almost completely sewn up by Paul Dacre and the Viscount Rothermere's Daily Mail. Chapter 2. Paul Dacre. Dacre's paper is like the drunken lout at a party who can't get anyone to like him. Suddenly all the girls are sluts and all the men are puffs and he's swinging at the chandelier before being huckled outside to vomit on the lawn. Andrew O'Hagan, London Review of Books, 1st of June, 2017. On the 4th of November, 2018, Paul Dacre delivered the keynote speech to the Society of Editors, SOE, annual conference. Unchallenged and valedictory, it was the perfect platform for a rare public foray from a man who is terrified of scrutiny and considers accountability to be a dirty word, at least for himself. Having recently glided upstairs to the chairmanship after 26 years as editor of the Daily Mail, the tone of self-congratulation in his speech was probably to be expected. Dacre's personal decades-long desperation to see the United Kingdom heading out of the European Union had been recently realised. Theresa May, his preferred successor to the despised David Cameron, was safely installed in Downing Street, and Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party was in a state of such epic disarray that Dacre anticipated her staying there for the foreseeable future. "In Westminster," claimed the self-appointed sage of Fleet Street, "the echo chamber has decided that Brexit is doomed and that the terminally incompetent Theresa May is toast, which is why the last rites are gleefully read over her every other day. Earlier this month, she was pronounced so dead that I'm surprised she was able to get up in the morning. She is, of course, still here and will, I predict, take the Tories into the next election." May, of course, hung on to the crumbling vestiges of power for just 9 months more, and would never lead the Tories into another general election. She was undone, inevitably, both by the impossibility of delivering a Brexit both feasible and desirable, and also by the willingness of Boris Johnson to betray anyone and lie to both party and country about what was achievable. The accuracy of Dacre's smug prediction here is of a piece with the entire speech. A masterclass in paranoia, delusion, and imagined persecution, it provides an insight into the strange, unpleasant mindset that drives the unprecedented damage that he, through his newspaper, has visited upon us all. Like Mackenzie, but unlike Murdoch, Dacre was his readership, at least as frightened by progress and by history and by foreigners and working mothers and sexual liberation as he exhorted his readers to be. Also, unlike Murdoch, he was always at enormous, endless pains to prove that his worldview was the only one worthy of respect. The level of subconscious self-doubt that presumably lies behind such an aggressive desire to decry any opposition to his views must be off the scale. But at the heart of his mission lay not just the denigration of dissenting voices, but the destruction of disagreement itself. For while Murdoch seeks to bend power to his will and revels in the respectability that his more broadsheet writers deliver, he secreted himself in the room when Michael Gove interviewed the newly elected President Trump for The Times in January 2017, although it was not mentioned in the article, Dacre always seemed dedicated to torching anything that might highlight his own ignorance, insecurities, and bigotries. Arguably, he used his newspaper to hide from himself so successfully that he ended up gaslighting a country. In his splendid 2017 unauthorized history of the Daily Mail, Mailmen, Adrian Addison quotes Duncan, one of the many journalists eager to pour scorn on their former boss. "I felt Dacre just saw life, the world, as an awful, threatening place where he wanted to be in his bunker, firing salvos out, you know, blowing up his enemies. That bunker mentality." It is as if, in addition to his own cosseted existence, he needed to create a public sphere in which he did not feel ridiculous, inadequate, and frightened. He needed to turn Britain into a bunker, and in many ways, he succeeded. Accordingly, nothing was off-limits or safe from his vitriol. The independence of the judiciary, academic freedom, even parliamentary democracy itself would come under extraordinary fire, all while claiming that he somehow upheld Britain or Christian values, despite championing serial sinners and routinely trashing the institutions and traditions that would once have provided vital checks and balances for the United Kingdom. Latterly, some of this mission can be explained by base avarice. In November 2021, he returned to the Mail as editor-in-chief of the paper's parent company, DMG Media, after a three-week hiatus during which Johnson had sought to install him as the supposedly impartial chairman of the media regulator Ofcom. The Guardian reported at the time that he had flunked the final interview and that individuals with knowledge of the recruitment process say this was despite Dacre being offered guidance on what to say in the interview and how to meet the job description criteria. Despite Dacre being found to be not appointable by the interviewing panel, Johnson and his Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, Nadine Dorries, elected to ignore the suitable candidates and award Dacre another bite of the cherry. He failed again and scurried back to the safety of the Mail. Humbled and humiliated by a rare foray outside his self-constructed comfort zone, this scourge of the establishment and tribune of ordinary people was now so devoured by desperation for a peerage that he sacrificed any last vestiges of journalistic integrity on the altar of his own ambition. Acutely conscious of the fact that only Boris Johnson would be sufficiently unscrupulous to put him in the House of Lords, he presided over the period in which the Daily Mail detached itself entirely from observable reality and became a Johnson fanzine. But despite Johnson's best efforts, Dacre's bid for the upper house crumbled after the launch of legal actions over alleged intrusion into privacy by the Mail's publisher. Coincidentally, I'm sure, Dorries, a vicious online troll who routinely used parliamentary privilege to abuse critics, became a Daily Mail columnist in April 2023 and would soon be railing against her own failure to secure a peerage promised by Boris Johnson. The disgraced former Prime Minister himself followed her onto the paper in June, the day after publication of the Committee of Privileges report that found him to be in repeated contempt of Parliament and an egregious serial liar. It was not, however, mere vanity and hunger for honours that saw Paul Dacre do more than any other individual in the United Kingdom to create the ecosystem in which austerity, Brexit, Boris Johnson and Liz Truss could happen. That story starts much earlier and runs much deeper and darker. If I had a different job and did not deal with its results every day, I would be sceptical that a single newspaper editor could have exerted such a malign influence over a population. But the callers who regale me with fact-free diatribes about immigration or the EU, impassioned paeans to incompetent or morally bankrupt politicians, and callous dismissals of the financially insecure, display a furious certainty that can only be explained by their daily residence in the Dacre echo chamber. Until they end up on my show, these largely decent people have literally never been asked to explain what they mean by the term woke, or asked precisely what EU laws they object to, or what elements of immigration they are desperate to control, and why. When I first heard callers use the phrase cultural Marxism, for example, I had no idea what they were talking about. It is, I learned, a conspiracy theory widely regarded as far-right and anti-Semitic that accuses an unidentified intellectual elite of being embarked upon a secret international mission to replace Christian and conservative values with ill-defined liberal ills. Clearly crackers and deeply dangerous, the Nazis used the phrase cultural Bolshevism to similar effect, Dacre was already banging this particularly ugly drum when he gave the Hugh Cudlip Memorial Lecture on the 22nd of January 2007, claiming the BBC exercises a kind of cultural Marxism in which it tries to undermine conservative society by turning all its values on their heads. This is not normal. A national newspaper editor, ostensibly at the top of his game and in the process of being feted by his peers, was deploying insightful language favoured by white supremacist conspiracy theorists in 2007. It gets worse. The proof that the BBC, an obviously imperfect institution that ties itself in knots in pursuit of impartiality, is a corrupt force, lay not in evidence or detail, but in their unspecified support for Labour, European federalism, the state and state spending, mass immigration, minority rights, multiculturalism, alternative lifestyles, abortion and progressiveness in the education and the justice systems. The BBC does not, indeed cannot, endorse any of these positions, but it does, on the handful of programmes that invite opinion, air them. That is what Dacre's Mail spent nearly three decades decrying. Any form of challenge to his own carefully curated conspiracy theories was to be dismantled by painting his foes in ludicrous hyperbole. There is nothing new here. In the fortnight following his infamous and profoundly racist Rivers of Blood speech in Birmingham on the 20th of April 1968, Enoch Powell received some 100,000 letters of support. Many of his correspondents reflected Dacre's later views of the BBC. Why is BBC allowed to get away with being so biased? It is said to be riddled with communists. Woman from Ascot, Berkshire. The immense propaganda machine of the BBC and the press are against the people. Unidentified constituent. I now find the BBC as a platform for every self-acknowledged enemy of Britain. Woman from Bath. Historically, totalitarian leaders need to impose media in which their warped version of truth is the only one available to the people, and anyone challenging it is a fifth colonist or enemy within, another of Powell's favourite tropes. They normally have to enlist tame editors to deliver these alternative realities. Paul Dacre did it unprompted, and if Murdoch did away entirely with the notion of moral compasses in public life, Dacre created the toxic myth that he was using the only authentic one to protect the public from, inter alia, political correctness, cultural Marxism, communists, and foreigners. Always foreigners. Perhaps the best way to understand his contribution to public discourse in the United Kingdom is to see him as a precursor to Twitter trolls, except with an enormous inherited follower count that dwarfed anybody else on the platform and no interest in engaging with replies. He has spent his career spewing baseless invective about imagined enemies and threats to an audience kept permanently cowed by the commoditization of fear. Crucially, and quite deliberately, he never exposed himself to proper scrutiny or even mild questioning about his myriad unhinged claims. And so, by the time of the Brexit referendum, 10 years after that ridiculous Cudlip lecture, swathes of the country shared his nonsensical fear of the BBC, progressiveness, and foreigners. Always, always foreigners. 7 false articles of faith were preconditions for the breaking of Britain. First, that the international economic collapse of 2008 was somehow caused by public spending in the UK. The comedian Alexei Sale put it best in 2019 when he described the idea that the 2008 financial crash was caused by Wolverhampton having too many libraries. Second, that leaving the EU would somehow improve the UK in materially measurable ways, whether by freeing up £350 million a week to spend on the NHS or ushering in cheaper food and higher standards of living. Third, the belief that people coming here from other European Union countries to provide much-needed labour in pretty much every sector was somehow to the detriment of the national interest. Fourth, that international and domestic institutions designed to protect populations and safeguard societies were secretly dedicated to damaging or destroying them. Fifth, that politicians and other public figures on the right side of Brexit or confected culture wars or the immigration debate should be exempt from the scrutiny and standards to which everybody else must be exposed. Sixth, that the pursuit of heretics, unbelievers, and enemies of the people should be vicious and unstinting. And seventh, the publication of blatant lies and the promotion of obvious liars. Nowhere did all 7 preconditions meet as completely as in the pages of the Daily Mail. And if Boris Johnson was to prove the messianic apotheosis of this horror show, Paul Dacre was his John the Baptist. There is some crossover with the focus of the last chapter. Here, Dacre's 2018 SOE speech echoes James Murdoch's self-serving desperation to believe that commercial success brought about by pandering to readers' worst impulses somehow justifies the abandonment of standards and truth. Freed from the obligation of having to connect with enough consumers to turn a shilling, such media organisations lose contact with the real world and have little idea how money works and indeed are suspicious of profit. Often hijacked by ideologues, invariably from the left, they almost always regard with contempt the mass-selling papers which need to appeal to large audiences in order to survive commercially. But again, Dacre did not peddle his invented enemies, mythical conspiracies and bogus victimhood because it was good for business. He did so because he believed implicitly, albeit absurdly, that people like him really were under mortal threat from, say, The Guardian. Consider for a moment how many people you can name today who both fit Dacre's description of hugely influential ideologues here and enjoy a sizable media platform from which to share their views. Guest slots and Twitter do not apply. Only big circulation newspaper columns or TV and radio shows. Ask around. Maybe make a list. It is highly unlikely to get anywhere close to double figures. And yet, as we have seen and will continue to see in these pages, there are legions of loud and powerful voices on Dacre's side of every argument. Tragically, and very repetitively for a newspaper man, he expounds the same conspiracy in each of the 3 major speeches he gave in his career, the Cudlip and 2 to the SOE. There is a rather obvious reason why, with the exception of the former Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger, he always fails to name a single individual in these diatribes. It is the same reason why he could never make these claims in a forum where he would be required to do so. There is no existential threat to his post-Powell propaganda, and there is barely any challenge at all to it across the entire UK media landscape. And yet still, he, his imitators and his readers cower in fear of invented foes. Such unchallenged cant is both a cornerstone of democratic corruption and the dominant hallmark of Dacre's mail. It will never be possible to measure how many people were seduced into this grimly timorous worldview by his or Murdoch's title. How much of their work engendered jingoistic fearfulness, for example, and how much merely pandered to it. But either way, Dacre remains fascinating and uniquely important to understanding our unfolding national tragedy because he is both a major driver and an almost perfect exemplar of the prejudices, falsehoods, and hypocrisies that lie at its heart. Such is the nature of gaslighting that this is all much easier to see from the outside. In February 2017, the unpaid and anonymous editors of Wikipedia voted overwhelmingly to ban the Daily Mail as a trusted source for the website, describing it as generally unreliable and calling for its use as a reference is to be generally prohibited, especially when other more reliable sources exist. Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales later explained to CNBC in America, "I think what they've done brilliantly in this ad-funded world is they've mastered the art of clickbait. They've mastered the art of hyped up headlines. They've also mastered the art of, I'm sad to say, of running stories that simply aren't true. And that's why Wikipedia decided not to accept them as a source anymore. It's very problematic. They get very upset when we say this, but it's just fact. So there you go." Neither the original decision nor Wales's comments were widely reported in the UK. The more evidentially challenged callers to my radio show may all sound like Daily Mail columnists, but they will, of course, not necessarily be Daily Mail readers. They are all Dacres people, though. The untrue stories and the unfounded opinions that proliferate in the public space can almost always be traced back to the sort of journalism he pioneered. And while it can make for compelling and commercially popular radio to tug at a single loose thread of their certitude and then watch the whole shoddy outfit unravel, Dacre himself is painstakingly careful never to expose himself or his henchmen to comparable treatment. His behaviour in the office may have been tyrannical. His use of the expletive cunt, for example, was reportedly so liberal that his hysterical critiques of underlings became known as the vagina monologues. But as we have seen, outside the office, where he would have to engage with people not reliant on his favour for their livelihoods, he has spent his entire professional life in hiding. There, he created an organ entirely in his own image, forging a template subsequently copied by both newspapers and broadcasters. To understand his modus operandi is to understand how his brand of hate-filled propaganda became so pervasive. At its root is the intimidation and silencing of all critics while claiming that it is, again, the other side that is really pursuing this censorial course. Because barely anybody fits the description of supposed foes, this constantly evolving paranoia has seen in recent years Dacre's successors and acolytes in politics and journalism resort to attacking the spectacularly unspecific woke mob, the blob, the new liberal elite, and even the tofu-eating wokerati. They do so because the landscape created by Dacre's weaponized paranoia in informal partnership with successive conservative governments and Rupert Murdoch's media empire demands enemies. Stab-in-the-back mythologies demand people-wielding daggers. Consider the philosophical and intellectual impossibility of inhabiting any sort of leftist echo chamber in a UK where newspapers exert enormous influence on news coverage, not just on sympathetic broadcast outlets, but also on the supposedly impartial BBC. Daily Mail editorials will be mentioned on BBC newspaper reviews, their nonsenses cited as genuine news by journalists who lack the independence and freedom of anonymous Wikipedia editors. One of the most frequently recurring themes on my show is how the length of the metaphorical queue for the Funfair ghost train will always dwarf the queue for the Speak Your Weight machine. Humans often seem to favour fear over facts. Horror films, moral panics, and front-page warnings about the imminent invasion of our island nation by swarms of foreign-born humans all support the idea that we actively enjoy being frightened. I could fill a whole book with examples, but here are a few helpful, earlier Dacre-era headlines. How using Facebook could raise your risk of cancer, 19th of February 2009. How Labour threw open doors to mass migration in secret plot to make a multicultural UK, 10th of February 2010. One out of every five killers is an immigrant, 31st of August 2009. Britain is the country of choice for many feckless Poles, 7th of November 2006. The swarm on our streets, 31st of July 2015. Dacre didn't merely exploit or pander to this impulse to be terrorised, he lived it. He truly believes not only that the problem with the echo chamber is that its inhabitants increasingly haven't a clue what real people in Britain outside the M25 are thinking, but also that he is their champion, a paragon of anti-elitism and a tireless critic of the establishment. We will shortly examine his credentials for this claim. Another part of his genius lay in telling people what to be furious or frightened about, while simultaneously claiming that his readers don't care about precisely the issues that fill his pages daily. When you develop the ability to step back from the fray, the results of this entirely unconscious dissonance veer from the ridiculous to the rancid. His columnists and editorials whine endlessly about the very issues that Dacre insists real people in Britain completely disregard. I'll tell you what those people aren't talking about, he promised in the 2018 SOE speech. They aren't obsessing about the Me Too movement or transgender rights or equal pay for BBC women journalists. In fact, his readers are often to be found obsessing about precisely these issues, but only because Dacre's lackeys portray them as threats or dangers. I don't think he realizes how egregiously he is lying when he makes these claims. He's too far gone for that. Let's look very briefly at his newspaper's coverage of the Me Too movement. In the unlikely event that you are unaware of it, a helpful explanation was provided by Mail Online editor-in-chief P. Dacre, some 7 months before he claimed that people weren't talking about it. In the wake of sexual misconduct revelations about Harvey Weinstein, millions shared their stories about being sexually harassed and assaulted. The movement began in October 2017 after actress Elisa Milano followed on a suggestion from a friend of a friend and tweeted, "If you've been sexually harassed or assaulted, write Me Too as a reply to this tweet." In 2022 alone, the Mail reported in print or online that the actress Joanna Lumley had candidly voiced her opinions on the Me Too movement and claimed it is mad that people are now calling themselves victims. Minnie Driver spoke out about her complex feelings surrounding the Me Too movement, admitting that while it was satisfying to see many female colleagues receiving justice, she also struggled watching disingenuous women discuss their experience. Mia Wasikowska shared her Me Too story after turning her back on Hollywood. I was young. I didn't know how to protect myself. Oscar-winning director Oliver Stone said sexual assault allegations against colleague Paul Haggis are possibly a result of the hashtag Me Too movement. Margot Robbie revealed that there are still problems with abuse in Hollywood following the hashtag Me Too movement. Dame Emma Thompson said that Amber Heard's blockbuster sex assault libel battle against Johnny Depp was not representative of the wider Me Too movement. Beyoncé is running hashtag Me Too checks on producers and artists for her album Renaissance after one of her former collaborators was arrested on sexual assault charges. Emily Ratajkowski claims Me Too movement has not changed things because men are only afraid of consequences and don't change their behaviour. We could go on, only pausing to wonder how much coverage would be given to an issue in which his readers were interested. On the 3rd of January 2013, over 5 years before Dacre's claim that his readers, his people, were not interested in stories about transgender rights, Lucy Meadows, a transgender primary school teacher from Accrington, Lancashire, complained to the Press Complaints Commission, PCC, of harassment from the press. She specifically cited a Daily Mail column written by Richard Littlejohn on the 20th of December 2012. Among other baseless slurs, Littlejohn had accused Meadows of putting his sick own selfish needs ahead of the well-being of the children. The then Star columnist on a newspaper whose readers, according to Dacre, did not care about the issue at all, went on to describe entirely without evidence the devastating effect that Meadows' gender reassignment might have on her young pupils. On the 19th of March 2013, Meadows took her own life. At the inquest into her death, coroner Michael Singleton accused the Daily Mail of ridicule and humiliation and a character assassination of Lucy Meadows, concluding, "I will be writing to the government to consider now implementing in full the recommendations of the Leveson Report in order to seek to ensure that other people in the same position as Lucy Meadows are not faced with the same ill-informed bigotry as seems to be displayed in the case of Lucy. And to you, the press, I say shame. Shame on all of you." Helpfully, Dacre shared his thoughts on Leveson in the SOE speech, calling it that massive misjudgment and overreaction by a prime minister trying to save his skin after his insistence against all advice on taking a crooked, disgraced News of the World editor to number 10 as his media advisor. In at least one way, Littlejohn embodies Dacre's claim to represent the interests and sensibilities of people outside the M25. He has spent much of his career as a Daily Mail columnist, writing from his home in Florida. The newspaper initially defended this column, even deploying Dacre's time-honoured penchant for bogus victimhood. "It is regrettable that this tragic death should now be the subject of an orchestrated Twitter storm fanned by individuals, including former Labour spin doctor Alistair Campbell, with agendas to pursue." Apart from Rusbridger, who stopped editing The Guardian in 2014, Campbell, who left Tony Blair's government in 2003, is the only person ever cited by Dacre as evidence of an enormous influential cabal of prominent media and political figures. Little John's column was later quietly removed from the Mail website. In January 2004, Dacre gave a vanishingly rare interview to Sue Lawley on Desert Island Discs. Asked what his staff likely thought of him, he replied, "I think they'd say he's a hard bastard, but he leads from the front." He is, of course, nothing of the sort. Like all bullies, he is a coward, and like all cowards, he avoids confrontation at all costs. Another of Adrian Addison's mailman sources recalls, "It always amused me that his shoe leather never wore out, because every day he was on a carpet in the office. He strode out the door and was in a car, which deposited him either at home or a restaurant. He would be horrified at what modern Britain had become, but he was never part of it." Addison, incidentally, begins and ends his book with an invitation to Dacre to be interviewed. It will never happen, partly because of innate gutlessness and partly because of the length of the charge sheet against him. When, for example, Miriam González Durantes, the international trade lawyer and wife of former Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, guest-edited BBC Radio 4's Today programme at Christmas 2015, she invited Dacre to discuss the treatment of women by the media. Again, he declined, cognizant, no doubt, of the way he had treated her. "It started on the first day of the 2010 general election campaign," she wrote later, in response to reports that Boris Johnson wanted to install him as the head of Ofcom. "When he sent a photographer to my home to stand there for weeks, from dusk to dawn, taking pictures every time I left the house, regardless of whether I was going to my office or to buy a pint of milk. Dacre used those pictures in all sorts of ludicrous articles. It went on for years. Articles about the shape of my derriere, about my role as a wife and mother. He suggested my dead father was a fascist and even claimed I benefited from human rights abuses in a northern African country. With time, I realised that it was just a tactic to tame people, a sheer demonstration of power, flexing his muscles to let my husband, Nick Clegg, see how much damage he could inflict on his family." Prince Harry explained this tactic further in his witness statement to the phone hacking trial of Mirror Group newspapers in June 2023. "It is important to remember the former Mirror editor Piers Morgan is a former Murdoch editor, a current Murdoch employee, a former Mail columnist and a former editor at large of the Mail Online website. Unfortunately," Harry alleged, "as a consequence of me bringing my Mirror Group claim, both myself and my wife have been subjected to a barrage of horrific personal attacks and intimidation from Piers Morgan, who was the editor of the Daily Mirror between 1995 and 2004, presumably in retaliation and in the hope that I will back down before being able to hold him properly accountable for his unlawful activity towards both me and my mother during his editorship." Dacre's treatment of Ed Miliband's family was arguably even worse. In 2013, the then Labour leader was riding high in the polls and in with a decent chance of winning power within the next 2 years. Despite his personal disdain for the incumbent Conservative Prime Minister, David Cameron, the prospect of Ed Miliband as PM clearly appalled Dacre. One of his most loyal attack dogs, Jeffrey Levy, was duly charged with putting the frighteners on him, just as González Durantes described. The resulting article remains one of the most outrageous ever to appear in a British newspaper. It also marks a major acceleration of Dacre's decline from blatantly bigoted but brilliant editor into the unhinged hysteric who would shortly be traducing anything and anyone perceived as being an obstacle to the mythical good Brexit. The article appeared under the headline "The Man Who Hated Britain" on the 27th of September 2013. And contained a character assassination of Miliband's father Ralph, a Jewish refugee who fled to Britain before the Second World War and died in 1994. Miliband Jr., who had called for a review of media ownership laws shortly after becoming Labour leader, defied convention by publicly and strenuously objecting to the article. It is worth setting the opening paragraph of Levy's obloquy alongside Ed Miliband's defence of his father, published in characteristically graceless fashion by Dacre 3 days later. Drawing on an adolescent diary entry made by Miliband Sr. in 1940, Levy wrote, On a hot summer day, a young man made his way alone to Highgate Cemetery in North London to make a lifelong vow. Solemnly, he stood at the grave of Karl Marx at a moment when, in his own words, the cemetery was utterly deserted. I remember standing in front of the grave, fist clenched, and swearing my own private oath that I would always be faithful to the workers' cause. Referring to the 3 years his father had spent serving in the Royal Navy, something glossed over by Levy in a single line, Miliband responded, "It was June 1944, and the Allies were landing in Normandy. A 20-year-old man who had arrived in Britain as a refugee just 4 years earlier was part of that fight. He was my father, fighting the Nazis and fighting for his adopted country." That Miliband was afforded a right of reply at all marked a departure from Dacre's normal way of doing business. The context in which it appeared, by contrast, was entirely on brand. Miliband's moving attempt to redress the abuse heaped upon his dead war hero father appeared above a reprint of Levy's original attack and alongside an editorial headlined, "An Evil Legacy and Why We Won't Apologise," that explained Miliband had stamped his feet and demanded a right of reply. It insisted, "Today we stand by every word we published on Saturday, from the headline to our assertion that the beliefs of Miliband Sr. should disturb everyone who loves this country." The deeply unsavoury episode also provided a helpful illustration of why Dacre never exposes himself to interview and prefers his executives to observe a similar form of purdah. A hapless deputy, John Stiefel, appeared on Newsnight in the midst of the furore and was forced to admit that an online version of the story featuring a photograph of Ralph Miliband's gravestone and a crass pun had been wrong and subsequently changed. "That did not appear in the paper," he pleaded. "It may very well be an error of judgment." As far as I have been able to establish, Stiefel's appearance on the 1st of October 2013 was the last time an executive from Dacre's Mail, whether during his time as editor, chairman, or editor-in-chief of parent company DMG Media, voluntarily exposed themselves to public scrutiny in this way. It is, as we have seen, easy to understand why. And yet still they insist that it is everyone else who inhabits an echo chamber. Disgusting though it was in isolation, the Ralph Miliband episode, and particularly the deployment of the phrase "evil legacy" in relation to a man who actively fought the Nazis, is significant for another, even more troubling reason. We must tread carefully here. The intention is not to suggest that the current owner of the Daily Mail or any of its editors should be held responsible for the views of their ancestors and predecessors. They could perhaps do more to repudiate or acknowledge them, but we will leave this sort of lazy, dishonest imputation to Dacre and his crew. Rather, it is to highlight the double standards of moral bankruptcy required to malign the memory of one man's dead father in a newspaper owned by a man whose own forebears didn't fight the Nazis, but fated them. In 1938, the Daily Mail published an article under the headline, "German Jews Pouring Into This Country." The language is eerily reminiscent of that deployed in Dacre's headlines about feckless Poles or the swarm on our streets. The opening paragraphs of the article, arguably even more so. "The way stateless Jews and Germans are pouring in from every port of this country is becoming an outrage. I intend to enforce the law to the fullest." In these words, Mr. Herbert Metcalfe, the Old Street magistrate, yesterday referred to the number of aliens entering this country through the back door, a problem to which the Daily Mail has repeatedly pointed. The number of aliens entering this country can be seen by the number of prosecutions in recent months. It is very difficult for the alien to escape the increasing vigilance of the police and port authorities. In June 1934, the owner of the Daily Mail, Viscount Rothermere, Harold Harmsworth, wrote an article for his newspaper headlined, "Hurrah for the Black Shirts!" It was an encomium to the British fascist leader Oswald Mosley and his populist movement. And while Rothermere later withdrew support from Mosley's party, he remained an enthusiastic supporter of Adolf Hitler. In June 1939, he wrote to him, "My dear Führer, I have watched with understanding and interest the progress of your great and superhuman work in regenerating your country. 10 days later, on the 7th of July 1939, he wrote to Joachim von Ribbentrop, Hitler's foreign minister, "Our two great Nordic countries should pursue resolutely a policy of appeasement for, whatever anyone may say, our two great countries should be the leaders of the world." These are just two in a series of fawning telegrams sent by Rothermere to senior Nazis in the months leading up to the Second World War. They emerged in papers released from Foreign Office intelligence files in April 2005 and received rather less coverage in the Mail than the unknown refugee Ralph Miliband's teenage diaries from the same era would 8 years later. "Czechoslovakia is not of the remotest concern to us," Rothermere also wrote in his paper, as Hitler's intention to annex Sudetenland crystallised. "And when Britain and France accepted Hitler's demands at Munich in September 1938, the Mail insisted that appeasement brings to Europe the blessed prospect of peace." Support for appeasement was not confined to the Mail in British newspapers of the time, and again, it would be quite wrong to suggest that the current Viscount Rothermere be held in any way responsible for or hostage to his great-grandfather's views. At least as wrong, for example, as insisting that Ed Miliband be held responsible for his father's altogether less alarming ones. Back in the 21st century, the Daily Mail's output on the days immediately prior to the 2016 Brexit referendum would no doubt have titillated the Old Street magistrate, Mr. Herbert Metcalfe. An excellent and often oddly lyrical analysis by Tim Adams in The Observer on the 14th of May 2017 found that Dacre elected to put immigration scaremongering on his front page on 17 of the 23 weekdays leading up to the vote on the 23rd of June. Adams wrote, "Read in sequence, those front pages have something of the shape of the opening pages of Great Expectations. First, there is a series of front pages about Britain's wide-open borders. These stories are sparked by a Coast Guard's interception of a boat of 18 Albanian asylum seekers off the coast at Dymchurch. It follows with the splash that the boat had been bought on eBay. The following day, by implication, we get an extrapolation of what this boat portends. The headline identifies EU killers and rapists we failed to deport, and details, in the manner of Trump and Mexico, that thousands of violent thugs and rapists from the EU are walking Britain's streets, a number equivalent to a small town flooding in through Kent. The following week, we have our first view of Magwitch himself, Avni Metra, 54, who is surprised at his flat in Boreham Wood in the proximity of a kitchen knife and apparently wanted for murder 2 decades ago in Tirana. He is not alone. There is also the one-legged Albanian double killer, Saliman Barki, in Northolt. Though Albania and Kosovo, where the killers claim to come from, are not members of the EU, and it is not clear how leaving will do anything to prevent their arrival in Britain, the implication is clear. Cameron and his Remainers are bringing a town full of knife-wielding Albanian murderers to the home counties. The 2,500 reader comments under this story speak with one voice. Get them out now, and get us out now." And out we jolly well went. Although on the 7th of August 2022, some 6 years later, the Mail on Sunday front page claimed 4 in 10 boat migrants are from war-free Albania. If the anti-immigration Brexit Dacre sold to his readers had been covered by the Trades Description Act, they would surely be entitled to some sort of refund. Improbably, the pre-Brexit headlines that presaged Dacre's fears that Brexit might elude him proved even more shocking after the referendum. We will examine some of the most offensive and one truly reprehensible and frankly incomprehensible